Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Gretchen Borschelt of the National Women's Law Center, who examines Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's disturbing record on reproductive rights and women's health care. Bartlett Naylor of Public Citizen, who talks about the Trump administration's effort to dismantle the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and why his group opposes Kathy Kreniger's nomination to head the agency. And Amira Sequeira of National Nurses United, who discusses the launch of the House Medicare for All caucus and the political and economic issues involved in moving the U.S. to a universal single-payer healthcare system. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Trump administration's hardline policy on Iran could disrupt nations and peoples across the Middle East, especially the fragile coalition government in Lebanon. The powerful Shiite organization Hezbollah won parliamentary elections by a slim majority in May, and Washington hardliners have threatened to cut off U.S. aid. Its parliamentary rival, a coalition backed by the United States and Saudi Arabia, meanwhile has unraveled, leaving its leaders to cut their own deals to ensure continued political relevance. U.S. influence in the region appears to be diminishing, while Russia, which along with Iran has backed the winning side in the bloody conflict in neighboring Syria, is on the rise, including in Lebanon. Diplomatic and political sources in Beirut say the U.S. has signaled to Lebanese Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri that Washington would not have a favorable view if Hezbollah had an increased role in the next government. Hardliners close to the Trump administration have threatened to cut off military aid to Lebanon, while others want conditions imposed on U.S. aid to the country. Last year, Russia floated a $1 billion credit line with favorable repayment terms for the Lebanese government to purchase Russian arms and equipment for the Lebanese army. But the offer was scuttled after the U.S. and Britain threatened to pull their respective military assistance programs to Lebanon if Beirut accepted the deal. The Guardian newspaper reports that oil-rich Nigeria has overtaken India as the nation with the greatest concentration of extreme poverty in the world. There are warning signs that within the next 12 years, the African continent will be home to 9 out of 10 of the world's poorest people. According to researchers at the Brookings Institution, 87 million people live in extreme poverty in Nigeria, more than the 73 million in deep poverty in India. India's economic prospects have improved with rapid economic and job growth. The report says 14 of the 18 countries in the world where the number of people in extreme poverty is rising are in Africa. The Democratic Republic of the Congo, currently ranked third, is also expected to overtake India soon. Increasing poverty in Africa has raised concerns among development experts at the United Nations, where attempts to reduce extreme poverty were seen as a success under the Millennium Development Goals. Andrew Shepherd, director of the Chronic Poverty Advisory Network at the Overseas Development Institute, observed that the situation appears to be exacerbated in African countries due to poor governance, harsher effects of climate change, and ongoing military conflicts. Los Angeles is the first city in the U.S. that is attempting to protect bank employees from their company's high-pressure sales tactics, such as those that triggered the Wells Fargo scandal. Wells Fargo bank employees were pressured to open 3 million fake accounts that cost unsuspecting customers monthly fees. A new city ordinance signed by Mayor Eric Garcetti requires banks that accept city deposits to demonstrate that it doesn't link employee pay to quotas imposed for the sale of bank products. Wells Fargo whistleblowers, who exposed the abuses at the bank, helped launch the Committee for Better Banks, a project of the Communication Workers of America. In contrast to the rest of the industrialized world, bank workers in the U.S. do not belong to unions and are forced to meet sales quotas. At Santander, a Spanish bank with branches across the United States, big collection centers deal with customers who may have fallen behind in payments for car loans. There, bank employees are told to use high-pressure tactics to extend the loans, which force customers to pay more on the back end. Now, union strategists, including Stephen Lerner, who ran the Justice for Janitors campaign, have set their sights on unionizing Santander workers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, federal Judge Brett Kavanaugh, makes the rounds of Senate offices to meet with officials who will vote on his confirmation, the Democratic Party and nonprofit groups representing a diverse set of constituencies are also gearing up to fight the nomination. One important constituency is women, against whose interests Kavanaugh has ruled many times, from reining in abortion rights to restricting access to birth control to discriminating against women workers. According to one academic analysis, Kavanaugh, if confirmed, would be the second most conservative justice on the court, to the right of Neil Gorsuch, Trump's previous appointee, and close to the radical right views of Clarence Thomas. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Gretchen Borschelt, Vice President for Reproductive Rights and Health at the National Women's Law Center in Washington, D.C. Here she outlines some of Kavanaugh's past court rulings that don't portend well for women's rights in a variety of areas. Judicial views he would likely carry with him if the Senate confirms the judge to take a seat on the nation's highest court.
Obviously, the right case would have to come along that would ask the court to revisit or give them the opportunity to revisit the Roe versus Wade decision. But we know it's not just hypothetical because cases are working their way through the lower courts. This has been a deliberate strategy of the anti-abortion movement to pass laws in the states that restrict or undermine access to abortion because they want to get a case before the court that would present that court with the opportunity. So there are a number of cases working their way through the courts right now that could get to the Supreme Court and give them that chance to overturn Roe. And if the court were to take that up and were to decide that Roe versus Wade is no longer law of the land, we know there are at least 20 states that are poised to seek to ban abortion immediately after that. There are a number of states across the country that have either their own constitutional protection for the right to abortion or that have some kind of state law that protects access to abortion. But it's really important to remember that if the Supreme Court were to overturn Roe versus Wade, then there would be no backstop in the Constitution, and the Congress and the President could sign a nationwide ban on abortion. So it wouldn't just be up to the states. And if Congress and the Trump administration, who would be interested in doing it, did that, then whatever a state wanted to do wouldn't really matter because there would be a nationwide ban in place.
Gretchen Borschelt, do you have other concerns about Judge Kavanaugh joining the Supreme Court apart from concerns around abortion rights?
Brett Kavanaugh has a really dangerous record when it comes to a range of women's issues. So on birth control, he has voted to allow employers' religious beliefs to override a woman's right to insurance coverage of birth control. So we're very concerned that he doesn't see that birth control is a fundamental right and that a woman's decision to use birth control deserves respect and should not be decided by her employer. That's one thing we're keeping an eye on. The other is that we know Judge Kavanaugh has been critical of the Affordable Care Act, and Trump promised to only appoint justices who would gut the Affordable Care Act. This is a priority for his administration. And so we're very concerned that if a case about the Affordable Care Act were to come before the court, Justice Kavanaugh could decide that it's not the law of the land anymore, or could decide to try and gut it and allow insurance companies to go back to some of those practices that really hurt women. Insurance companies used to charge women more for the same coverage as men. They used to deny coverage to women because of pre-existing conditions like having been pregnant or having had a cesarean delivery. Those were all practices that ran rampant before the Affordable Care Act came into place. So any backsliding on that could leave women's health in dire straits. We also know in employment discriminations, Judge Kavanaugh has cited against employees time and time again and read non-discrimination protections really narrowly, deferring to employers' arguments for why they're treating workers differently. So I think for women in the workplace, Judge Kavanaugh poses a real threat. And then we also know he's really shown a willingness to restrict students' rights in schools, particularly rights of students with disabilities, and that's a women's issue too. So across the board, what we know of his record is very, very concerning for women's rights, for workers' rights, for students' rights. And I think there's going to be more to come to light as we get more of his record exposed and we get the documents released.
When you talked about the birth control restrictions, was that the Hobby Lobby case?
So it was a case after Hobby Lobby. These were nonprofit organizations that wanted to refuse to participate in the program by which they were allowed to not provide birth control coverage, but they had to notify their insurance company to say, we don't want to provide coverage, insurance company, and then the insurance company still had to make sure women got that coverage. It was a deal that the Obama administration gave to nonprofit organizations who had religious objections to birth control. And Judge Kavanaugh said, nope, even telling these employers that they had to, you know, do this process and notify their insurance company, that in and of itself was a violation of religious beliefs. Because in their view, by telling the insurance company that they wanted out, they were still ensuring that women got the coverage they objected to. So they said, that's a trigger. And we don't want to trigger this coverage being given to women. And so Judge Kavanaugh would have just let them out of it completely, and the women wouldn't have got the coverage they needed.
But his side lost in that case?
That's right. He dissented, and he was an outlier there. His court, the other judges on his court, decided otherwise. They said, no, this is not a violation of religious liberty. And seven other courts that considered the case, they decided the same. So he was really an outlier with that decision. Judge Kavanaugh is not the nominee we need, and we really need a nominee who's going to commit to upholding women's constitutional rights, including the right to abortion. And we're encouraging people to make that known to their senators, to ask them to commit to that standard.
That was Gretchen Borschelt, Vice President for Reproductive Rights and Health at the National Women's Law Center. Find links to news about opposition to Judge Kavanaugh's nomination and groups engaged in the fight to preserve reproductive rights by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis, the worst since the Great Depression, the Consumer Financial Protection Board was created to protect consumers from unfair, deceptive, or abusive practices and take action against companies that break the law. The CFPB, as it's known, also arms people with information they need to make smart financial decisions. Yet when the Trump administration took office in January 2017, they moved quickly to dismantle the agency. CFPB acting director and Trump's director at the Office of Management and Budget, Mick Mulvaney, pulled back the Bureau's investigation into the massive Equifax data breach and dropped an investigation into a payday lender who donated to Mulvaney's congressional campaigns. On June 9th, Mulvaney fired his 25-member advisory board en masse. Despite the fact that the Bureau was created to protect consumers from predatory banking and lending practices, under Trump and Mulvaney, it's clear that their top priority is to close down the agency and protect Wall Street fraudsters. To that end, President Trump has nominated Kathy Kreninger, who works with Mulvaney at OMB, to become the next director of the U.S. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Not surprisingly, opposition to Kreninger is mounting, but Democrats in the Senate likely don't have enough votes to stop her confirmation. Your reporter spoke with Bartlett Naylor, financial policy advocate with Public Citizen, who talks about the Trump administration's effort to dismantle the CFPB and explains why his group opposes Kathy Kreninger's nomination to lead the agency.
Some of the most conspicuous problems have to do with debt collection and payday loans. These are the high interest rate loans. The CFPB has substantial authority under UDAP, Unfair, Deceptive, and Abusive Practices. Mulvaney has either terminated investigations or sharply reduce the restitution that consumers might bring. So, for example, last week he announced a penalty for a company of something like $500,000, but the restitution, which was millions, tens of millions of dollars, he eliminated. So in other words, the company may have enjoyed ill-gotten gains, but it doesn't have to give those back to the actual victims. Again, under Obama's director, they had returned some $12 billion to nearly 30 million consumers.
Tell us about Kathleen Kreniger, Donald Trump's nominee to become the next director of the Consumer Financial Protection Board.
The appointment of Kathleen, or the naming of Kathleen Kreniger as the director adds to the insult. She has zero background in finance, zero background in banking, zero background in consumer protection. She is about 43 years old. Currently, she is a lieutenant for Mick Mulvaney at the Office of Management and Budget. Before that, she worked for the Department of Homeland Security. In addition, she has worked as a staffer for a number of United States senators. But notice in all of that, I'm not saying anything about working for a bank, working for a consumer protection agency. The word finance doesn't come up. Her confirmation hearing last Thursday before the Senate Banking Committee went into subjects where she was expert. At OMB, she oversees five or six departments, two of which oversaw the caged children deterrent policy. That's the family separation policy at the borders. And while she's being touted as a manager, she declined to offer any details about her responsibility or even her opinion about the morality of separating children at the border to serve as a deterrent, a message to people further in Central America, for example, who might contemplate bringing their families out of as refugees to the United States. She was asked by Elizabeth Warren, by Jack Reed, by Senator Schatz, what's her opinion of that? And her response to that and every question was, I appreciate your question, but it's inappropriate to offer an opinion.
Although the Republicans control the Senate, is there any chance that senators might reject Kathy Kreniger as the next head of the CFPB?
I think there is a chance and a reasonable chance. Based on the questions, I did not hear any support. I heard all concern by all of the Democrats on the committee. If her nomination clears with complete Democratic opposition, it is possible, as you know, that one or two Republican senators might oppose her. It's clear that both the border, the caged children, the deterrence policy, the Puerto Rican issue are problems that cross the political lines, that there are certainly Republican senators that understand that these are woeful examples of mismanagement. If she is being touted as somebody who, while she lacks any financial consumer protection background, she's an expert manager, then at least one or two of these Republican senators might be convinced that this is not the right person.
That was Bartlett Naylor, financial policy advocate with Public Citizen. Learn more about the Trump administration's efforts to dismantle the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and opposition to Kathy Kreniger's nomination to lead the agency by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With the Trump administration's continuing effort to repeal or weaken the Affordable Care Act, triggering steep increases in health insurance premiums across the country, a majority of Americans appear ready to embrace
what virtually all other industrialized nations have, a universal healthcare system that covers all citizens. To that end, Democrats in the House of Representatives announced the formation of their new Medicare for All caucus on July 19th, which was launched with more than 70 supporting members. The caucus will back pending legislation, H.R. 676, which is the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, and they'll closely examine specific policy components necessary to implement a single-payer system in the U.S. The Medicare for All Act currently has 122 co-sponsors in the House. A public opinion poll conducted in March by the Kaiser Family Foundation, a nonpartisan health policy think tank, found that 59% of those surveyed supported a Medicare for All healthcare system in which all Americans would be covered by health insurance. Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign, where he advocated for Medicare for All, did much to popularize universal healthcare alternatives to the current failing system. Your reporter spoke with Amira Sequeira, legislative advocate with the National Nurses United Union, who talks about the launch of the House Medicare for All caucus and the political and economic issues involved in moving the U.S. to a universal single-payer healthcare system.
This was really a historic moment in the fight for a Medicare for All single-payer healthcare system in the United States, because it was the first time that a group of members of Congress have come together in an organized fashion to say, we believe a single-payer Medicare for All system is the solution to the healthcare crisis in this country, and we are going to work together to achieve it. So for Medicare for All single-payer activists across the country, this was really a groundbreaking day. And to add to that, when the caucus was introduced, there were 66 members in the caucus. We are now at 74 members of the House of Representatives who are in this new Medicare for All caucus, which is a big percentage of the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives. And so these members are going to be coming together to really dive into the details of a single-payer system, how we make this work, how we improve Medicare so that we can improve it and expand it, so it provides the health care that every person living in this country needs. So it was a really exciting day. We're very grateful to Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, and Congressman Keith Ellison, who are serving as the co-chairs of this caucus and help bring these now 74 members together to work together to achieve Medicare for All.
Amira, can you describe the broad outlines of Medicare for All and what it would look like, given the fact that people around the country are more or less familiar with Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which has not performed as many people hoped. So many people left behind. And of course, there are rising costs because the system, Obamacare, is still rooted in the private for-profit health insurance industry. And then, of course, you have the Trump administration attacking the good things that the ACA did in so many ways that it's a shadow of its former self. And even then, in its perfect form, it really wouldn't have met the needs of everybody in the country. But do tell us what Medicare for All would look like.
Well, the Affordable Care Act has allowed this country to make huge gains in making sure that more people are insured, especially through Medicaid expansion. Even in its perfect form, it could not have allowed for the low-cost, universal health care that we need. So Medicare for All system is a single-payer system. It would be similar to the health care system in Canada. And we're lucky because we already have a single-payer system in this country, and that's the Medicare program. So right now, Americans over the age of 65 get health insurance through the Medicare program. And so the way single payer works is it's basically a socialized insurance model where everybody is in one basically insurance system through Medicare. And what that means is then the Medicare program is the single payer for the healthcare system. So what we would do is in a Medicare for All system, we would take the current Medicare system, we would improve it. So it would include things like dental coverage, optical coverage, prescription drug coverage, and we'd expand it to include everybody in the country, not only people over the age of 65. So every person in the United States, no matter your race, gender, where you live, where you're from, would have quality therapeutic health care. You could see any doctor, you could see any hospital, any specialist, you'd show up with your Medicare card, and you would get the care you need without a copay, without a deductible, and without a premium.
With the launching of this Medicare for All caucus in the House of Representatives, does this signal that one of the two major political parties in this country is about to fully advocate for a single-payer system in the United States? And I guess I'm looking towards 2020, when the national conventions occurred. Will the Democratic Party, in your view, adopt Medicare for All as an important part of its party platform?
The Democratic Party would be crazy not to. Certainly, the launch of this caucus signifies a huge shift. The incredible support on the federal bills, with 122 members supporting the bill in the House and 16 members supporting the bill in the Senate. But it is up to us, it's up to regular people to hold those members of Congress accountable. It's not enough to just show support by signing on to a bill. You need to fight for this change. And hopefully we will see a new and improved progressive Democratic Party going into the 2020 elections. You know, I think this is an incredibly exciting time for Medicare for All, because there are literally hundreds of people running for office in the midterms who are running on Medicare for All. And they're running on Medicare for All because they believe in it, right? Because it's what everyday people in this country want. And that's what the Bernie campaign showed us. When Senator Sanders ran in 2016, the excitement around his campaign because of the Medicare for All proposal, along with a few others, it's undeniable that this country wants to see a shift to Medicare for All. So I think this is a really exciting time. I'm really looking forward to hopefully seeing a lot of people elected in various offices, locally, statewide, and federally, who support Medicare for All.
That was Amira Sequeira, legislative advocate with National Nurses United. Learn more about the efforts to expand Medicare to a universal single-payer healthcare system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPPP in Athens, Georgia, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KYAQ in Newport, Oregon, and more than 60 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.